Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We tonight are going to pick up in Leviticus 23. So you can turn there. And as I mentioned at the end of last week, we're going to get into the various religious feasts, festivals. The Hebrew word actually means set time. So these are the set times of the Lord. We are dealing with a God in the Bible who is very specific, who is in charge of time, and who is aware of the effects of time on the human race. And because he's very big on remembering, we see that word a lot in the Bible, remember, remember. And so he's going to set particular days for particular feasts during which time the Israelites have to remember particular things. And they're going to do this, like everything in the law, they're going to do this for 1,400 years, give or take. And they're not going to know why they're doing it. And then Jesus walks on the stage of history and is going to fulfill these feasts to the day, to the letter, in sequence, exactly. However, in order for him to fulfill these feasts exactly, in order, specifically the way they're laid out, there's just no way for him to die on Friday, be buried Friday night, get up Sunday morning, and fulfill these feasts, despite the fact that there are references in the New Testament to Christ fulfilling the feast. But there's simply no way to say he fulfilled these feasts and he died on Friday and he got up Sunday morning. So we have a dilemma. And that's one of the things that we're going to talk about as we go through these feasts and then as we compare them to the New Testament. On our website, if you go to the Q&A section, there is a Q&A called the Passion Week of Christ that includes the Passion Week chart, which I just happen to have printed out here. And in the Passion Week chart, I took the time to go through day by day the final week of Jesus on the planet with all the scripture references to show you day by day what Jesus was going through, because I contend, and stop me when this is too obvious, I contend that Jesus actually knew what he was talking about. Yeah, I know. I know. And that Jesus understood what constituted a day and what constituted a night. And that when he said in Matthew 12, 38 to 40, they came and said to him, Master, we'll see a sign from you. He answered and said to them, an evil, adulterous generation seeks after a sign. And there shall no sign be given it but the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. I assume Jesus knew what he was saying when he said that. And the Bible had for 1,400 years been perfectly predicting the sequence of events in these feasts that would fall sequentially and perfectly in such a way that he would be the fulfillment of each of these feasts. And the reason that we don't see it as clearly in the modern church is because we have this date stamp of Friday to Sunday imposed on the resurrection, death, burial, resurrection story of Christ. And as long as you think Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you can't embrace the feasts. So I'm going to go with the Bible's true. And since nowhere in the Bible does it say that he died on Friday, it's very clear that he rose on the first day of the week, but nowhere does it say what day he died on. So I contend that it was an actual 72 hours, 3 days, three nights. And if you allow for that, if you start with sundown Saturday night, which would be the beginning of the first day of the week, and if you simply let 72 hours tick back from there, sure enough, every one of the feasts fall dead in line with each of the major occurrences in his death, burial, and resurrection. So I like the way the Bible works. Yes?
Now, wouldn't technically Friday start Thursday night I mean, what we think of as Thursday night.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
Now, how does this mess up with theology, though? Because some people think that Jesus might have died on a Friday just because of, like, the sunrise service and stuff like that.
Yes.
Is that why this is important?
No one in the early church, no one for the first 250, 300 years of the church, knew anything about Good Friday. But as a result of the Ishtar feast, the 40 days of weeping for Tammuz, culminating in the day of Freya, the Friday before the day of the sun, all of those Babylonish ideas were imposed on the Christian church. And so we need to be willing to unravel that and get back to what does the Bible actually say about these things. And yes, those traditions die hard. Even as I'm saying this, there are people listening to it and going, no, he has to die on Friday. I always believed he died on Friday because tradition dies hard. But there's nowhere in the Bible that says he died on Friday. Instead, what it says is he died on the day before the Sabbath. And so people say, Sabbath is Saturday, day before would be Friday. Therefore, he died on Friday. But when you look at these feasts include Sabbaths as well. And those Sabbaths can fall on any day of the week. So let's start there. Let's dig in at chapter 23. The Lord spoke again to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, the Lord's feasts or appointed times, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, my appointed times are these. For 6 days, work may be done, but on the seventh day, there is a Sabbath of complete rest, a holy convocation. And you shall not do any work. It is the Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwellings. So there's the weekly Sabbath established. From there he says, and these are the appointed times, the set times of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at the times appointed for them. In the first month. Now what is the first month on the Jewish calendar? Anybody know?
Nisan
or Abib? Nisan is not an automobile from Japan. On Nisan the 14th, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at twilight is the Lord's Passover. Now, as Jeff rightly said, the Jewish calendar was a lunar calendar. Unlike our Greco-Roman calendar, our Julian calendar that we still live off with it, which is a solar calendar. So our day goes from midnight to midnight. But on the Middle Eastern calendars, that the Hebrew calendar was typical of, boy, that was a bad sentence. The Hebrew calendar, typical of most Middle Eastern calendars, was a lunar calendar, a far better sentence. And what that meant was the day began at sundown. And so right now is what is called the evening. Our English word that we're so used to saying, evening, comes from the evening of the light and the dark. When the light and dark are even, that was referred to as the even or the evening. That is also the word from which we get the word eve. That's just a shortened version of the even or the evening. So when you talk about Christmas Eve or even Halloween, which is All Hallows Even, we've just gotten rid of the V over time. So that concept is the beginning of the next day at the evening of the dark and light. So right now is the beginning. On a lunar calendar, right now as you look outside, and it's kind of dark, kind of light, we are now beginning Thursday.
This is eventide.
It's eventide. See how that word has worked its way into our language? And we don't give it any thought anymore because our day doesn't start there. But it was very important to the Hebrew mind to know when the day began because you had to be in your house and have everything prepared for the Sabbath at this time of day on Friday night, because that was the beginning of the Sabbath. And it went until the even on Saturday. And so God's very specific. It says, on the 14th day at evening, at even, at twilight, it's the Lord's Passover. Then on the 15th day of the same month, unleavened bread. So he says, then on the 15th day of the same month, there is a feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. Now, both of those feasts actually have a connection to Israel's history in their deliverance out of Egypt. Of course, we all know the story of the Passover, and we know when the Passover occurred, and it happened on the 14th of Nisan. That's all very clear in the Exodus story. And then the next day was the first day that they ate unleavened bread at the beginning of their travels. And so these two feasts, Passover and unleavened bread, back-to-back days, actually have a historic significance that would resonate with the Hebrews every year as they kept these feasts. But then God just starts adding feast days that don't look backward to any specific event. They're looking forward 1,400 years to an event that's going to happen. Here's what you need to know. For 7 days, you shall eat unleavened bread. So the Feast of Unleavened Bread is a 7-day feast. Now here's an important concept. Because you're talking about 30-day months, that's why on our calendars, if you try to keep track of when Passover is, Passover moves on our calendar because the lunar calendar is 360 days. Ours is 365 and a quarter, give or take a few inches here and there. And so every year, Passover moves on our solar calendar because they're keeping time by their lunar Hebrew calendar. So every year that goes by, the 14th day of the month or the 15th day of the month can fall on any day of the week, just like it does on our calendar. That's why, though you may have been born on 6, 7, 8, 9, like Megan was, she was born on June 7th. But I couldn't tell you what day of the week that was. There's probably somebody out there with a calculator who could tell you what day of the week 6, 7, 8, 9 was. But we don't count her birthday based on the day. We don't go, well, the second Thursday in June, that's Megan's birthday. It's the date of the calendar that designates her birthday, June 7th. And so, same thing, the 14th of Nisan can fall on any day of the week. There's no designated specific day. The 15th is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. For the next 7 days, you're going to have the feast. It's a 7-day long feast, 8 days if you count Passover. Now look, verse 7. On the first day of unleavened bread, on the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. So what does that make the first day? It's a Sabbath. So the 15th is a Sabbath day. But it's not what we just read in verse 3. It is not a weekly Sabbath. The weekly Sabbath happens every Saturday. But the Holy Convocation Sabbath happens on the 15th, regardless of what day of the week that is. Do you understand? Somebody look up John 19:31 for a moment. Because John, you've heard me say this many times in our Sunday morning study, John assumes that you've already read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or some variation thereof. He already assumes that you know most of the Christ story, which is why he spends a lot of time filling in the blanks, telling stories that the others didn't tell. And then he assumes things, like he doesn't tell you that John the Baptist was beheaded. He just mentions it in passing and says, and this is after John was beheaded, like you would already know that that occurred. And so one of the things that the synoptics don't do in talking about Jesus' passion is that they don't clarify the Sabbath day that came up right behind Jesus' death. There is a Sabbath involved in his 3-day death, burial, and resurrection. And they mention that there's a Sabbath, but they don't clarify what kind of Sabbath. And so people just assumed, well, it's talking about Saturday. It's clearly a Saturday. Since he died before Sabbath, he died on Friday, and the Bible's clear that he got up on the first day of the week, so that makes Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But John then takes the time to clarify. Somebody got John 19:31? You got that, Tom?
Since it was the day of preparation, and so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away.
The Sabbath is coming. The Sabbath is bearing down on them. Jesus is on the cross, and they've got to get him off the cross before the Sabbath starts. So John takes the time to say, but that day was a high day. That was not a normal Sabbath. That was not a regular Sabbath. That was a high Sabbath. Why? Because we know that the day after Passover, and Jesus was killed on Passover, we know that the day after Passover is a Sabbath. It's a high day, regardless of what day of the week it is. And so John's the one who takes the time to tell us that next day was a high day. That is John 19:31. It's a very, very important phrase and very important to understand. Yes, Jeff?
Has anybody, they probably have, gone through the calendars to say, okay, this year, 0033 or whatever
right.
it happened to be?
Yeah. In fact, starting at Sir Robert Anderson, they started doing those calculations to try to figure out what years. Did the Passover fall on Friday? What day did it fall on Wednesday? What year did it fall on? The problem that we have is that our calendar is not accurate.
Yeah.
Our calendar simply isn't accurate. Yeah. At this point, people are saying that the birth of Christ was probably missed by 4 years. Mm-hmm. There are others that argue as many as 6 years, based on the mention of an eclipse that took place in the year that Herod died. And so now that we actually have computer models where we can turn the whole universe backwards and count, they now realize that the assumptions for BC AD
weren't quite right
and missed by 4 to 6 years. That being the case, our assumptions about, well, then Christ died, you know, if he was born at zero or one, since there's no year zero, if he was born at one and he died at age 33, that puts it about 33 AD. Well, it turns out that 33 AD doesn't fit the scenario. So again, we have to go by what does the Bible actually say about it and then plug in, like I'm doing on the board, plug in what the Bible does tell us. But our computer models, yes, people have done that and turned it backwards to see what the potential years are, which is fascinating.
All right, but we don't know that it was on a Wednesday, did we? We just know that it was that the next day was a non-Sabbath.
Right, right. And the reason that I conclude that it was a Wednesday is because we know it's 3 days and three nights.
Right.
And we know he got up at the beginning of the first day.
Okay, so we know he got up on a Sunday.
We know he got up on a Sunday.
Oh, okay. The
Bible says so.
Okay, all right.
So you go back 3 days, three nights.
Okay.
You end up at him dying on a Wednesday, and if that's true,
then
all of these feasts fit perfectly, and you don't have to twist anything. And that's why it's important that the Bible tells us what day he got up. It doesn't tell us what day he died.
Right.
The assumption is that he died on a Friday because of the reference to a Sabbath. So John telling us it's a high Sabbath means that we can move that Sabbath to wherever it's necessary.
Right.
Follow the logic there?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
I just didn't. I was like, well, what made him have to get up on a Sunday? But it said he got up on a Sunday.
It does say, first day of the week, as the women were going to the tomb on the first day of the week.
Okay.
That's very clear.
Okay.
So, yeah. Now, if you have a week-long feast, and the first day and the seventh day are holy days, somewhere in that week, whether that week starts on a Thursday and ends on a Thursday, or whether it starts on a Friday and ends on a Friday, whether it starts on a Monday and ends on a Monday, somewhere in that week, you're going to have a first day of the week. There's going to be a Sunday in there somewhere. Well, that's where the next feast falls. Verse 8 says, but for 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the seventh day is a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. So the first and the seventh day are Sabbath days. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land which I am going to give you and you reap its harvest, then you shall bring in the sheaves of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. And he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord for you to be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. So what's the day after the Sabbath?
Sunday.
Is a Sunday, first day of the week. Now, on the day When you wave the sheaf, you shall offer a male lamb, 1 year old, without defect, as a burnt offering to the Lord. Its grain offerings shall then be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering by fire to the Lord for a soothing aroma, with its libation, 1/4 of a hin of wine. Until the same day, until you have brought in the offering of your God, you shall eat neither bread nor roasted grain nor new growth. It is to be a perpetual statute throughout your generations in all your dwellings. And so that is called the Feast of First Fruits. So on the first day of the week, in the midst of the week-long Feast of Unleavened Bread, on the first day of the week, wherever that falls, is first fruits. And we know, just as the discussion with Jennifer emphasized, we know for sure, according to the New Testament, that Jesus got up on that first day of the week. Which is why Paul repeatedly refers to Jesus as the first fruit of the resurrection. Now that language makes no sense, except that Jesus got up on first fruits. Yes?
Am I understanding correctly, the night before the day on our calendar is when the next day starts?
Exactly.
And so, does it go on to when the sun comes up or to when?
No, it's a 24-hour period.
It is a 24-hour period.
Yes. Okay. Let's establish that for a moment, as long as you bring that up. Charlie?
On a Saturday night.
Yes. The women came Sunday morning while it was still dark. And did they find him coming out of the grave?
It was empty.
He was already gone. And in fact, the angel said, he's already gone. You'll see him again later in Galilee. He's gone. Okay. He's been gone. They came before sunup, and the grave was empty. They found an empty tomb. Okay. So, Charlie, look up John 11, verses 9 and 10 for a moment. Because the common argument for the Friday to Sunday scenario is they'll say, now by Jewish reckoning, you've probably all heard this, by Jewish reckoning, any part of a day constitutes a whole day. And then they'll say, so he died on Friday, that's one day, and you know, he was in the tomb just before sundown, so that's part of Friday. Then he was in there all day Saturday, that's 2 days, and then Sunday they came and he raised on Sunday at sunup, and that's 3 days. Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And you say, well, where are the nights in there? Because as I quoted at the beginning, Jesus said 3 days and three nights. And they'll say, no, by Jewish reckoning, any part of a day constitutes a 24-hour day. And then they'll show you verses that refer to a day and a night in the Old Testament. And they'll say, a day and a night is the same as saying a whole day, or as saying a 24-hour period. And then as they're saying that, they will dance really fast. Because they want very badly to convince you that by, quote, Jewish reckoning, a day and a night is made up in the phrase a day. And therefore, a day of Friday, a day of Saturday, and a day of Sunday is the 3 days and three nights that Jesus was talking about. That Jesus didn't mean three actual periods of day and night. He meant three a day and a nights. So the assumption here is that when Jesus said, Jonah was 3 days and three nights, I'll be 3 days and three nights, what that meant was any part of a day, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, constituted a day and a night. Therefore, Jesus didn't have to actually be in there because Jewish reckoning meant any part of a day constituted a whole day. But.
So people are making all these arguments just so that they can.
So they can keep Friday. So they can keep Friday.
Which is a pagan thing. That
exactly. Precisely. Now, Charlie, you're going to have to read nice and loud for us, but you just turn to John 11, verse 9 and 10. Here's Jesus talking, and he says,
Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day?
Hold on. In the next verse, he's going to compare that with night. And he just said there's 12 hours in a day. So can we say that the idiomatic Jewish understanding of Jesus speaking of a day and a night meant any part of a day? No, Jesus knew exactly that there were 24 hours in a whole day cycle, 12 in a day and 12 in a night. Right?
Right.
Go ahead and read the rest of it.
If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not with him.
So he understands day, and he understands night, and he defined day as a 12-hour period. So can we from that conclude that Jesus believed in an idiomatic Jewish day and a night where any part of the day constituted a 24-hour period? No, of course not. Jesus knew what a day was and what a night was. He was the speaking agency that spoke day and night into existence. He's the one who said, let there be light. He's the one who in the book of Genesis said, and that light period we called day, and the dark period's called night. He knows what a day and a night
and
is.
And there was a day and there was a night.
Yeah.
24 hours then.
And that was called the first day. And
yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's just funny to hear people try to impose on God a forced ignorance, as if the people 2,000 years ago didn't understand the difference between day and night and the 12 hours that make it up. But I think it's very, very important that Jesus said that. Are there not 12 hours in a day? This is the same Jesus who said, I'll be in the tomb 3 days and three nights. So he's talking 72 hours. Understand? Okay. You just let the Bible say what it says. It's just not that difficult. So now we have established that the 14th day of Nisan is the Passover. The 15th day is unleavened bread. The first day of the week is first fruits. We have one more feast then, starting at verse 15. You shall also count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day when you brought in the sheaf of the wave offering, and there will be seven complete Sabbaths. You shall count 50 days to the day after the seventh Sabbath, and then you shall present a new grain offering to the Lord. Here's what that means. You've got a first day of the week, first fruits. It happens somewhere in that week of unleavened bread. From that first day of the week, you count seven Sabbaths. That's a total of 49 days. That's seven sevens. Then he said, on the day after that, which places it on a Sunday, on the day after, the 50th day, on that day, you're going to have another feast. Because it has a 50 in it, that day has come to be known as Pentecost. It's got the Penta 50 right in it. It's also known as the Feast of Weeks because you count 7 weeks. And the day after you've counted the 7 weeks, on the 50th day, that day is called the Pentecost. So, 50 days, Pentecost. Now you know why, at the beginning of the book of Acts, Jesus told his disciples, it says that for 40 days he was there with them, talking about the kingdom, discussing the kingdom for 40 days. And then he tells them, tarry here at Jerusalem until you are endued with power from above. And then he sails off into the blue, and then we read very clearly, and when the day of Pentecost was fully come, and that's when the Holy Spirit fell. So these feasts on the 14th, the 15th, then the first day, and then 50 more days, those feasts are all fulfilled in Christ's death because we know for sure, clearly, that he died on Passover. He is the Passover lamb that took away the sin of the world. If he kept the Lord's Supper on Tuesday night, and if through Tuesday night he went through being passed back and forth between Pilate and Herod, if it was Tuesday night, which would have been the beginning of Wednesday, he ate the Passover and established the Lord's Supper, then on Wednesday he'd be on the cross, which would have been the 14th. The 15th was the high day, which is why they were in such a hurry to get him off the cross. That leaves
Friday.
That leaves Friday
for them to run and ask for them.
As a preparation day, which allows all the other stuff that the New Testament said happened. For instance, we know for sure that the Jewish leaders went to Pilate's court and asked for a guard to guard the tomb. And when they went, they said to him, because that deceiver said that in 3 days he'd get up again. Now, if he died on a Friday, and if he was up on Sunday, that means on the Sabbath day, Saturday, they went to the court of a Gentile, and they're the Jewish leaders. No, Alan's shaking his head. No, of course they didn't. No. How could they? No. And what was their big hurry? Why would they break the Sabbath to go do that, since out of their own mouths they said, we've got 3 days. So if you've got 3 days, you don't hurry in there on Saturday, because you're not expecting him to get up on Sunday. You're expecting 3 days to pass. So you wait till the first day of the week, and then you go see Pilate, and you go in and argue for the guard. It also says that the women went and bought burial spices. When and where, considering that everything shut down on the Sabbath? When and where did they have time to do that? No, they couldn't, because there's no time for them to do that.
Walmart.
Walmart, exactly. Go buy it from the Gentiles. I was going to make a really bad joke there, but it's good that I can edit myself. If the Lord's Supper was a Tuesday night, if over the course of Tuesday night, which was then technically Wednesday, into the morning Wednesday, if during that night he was passed back and forth between Herod and Pilate back and forth, and then, of course, on the morning of Passover, Pilate comes out and presents him to the mob and says, pick who you want. Do you want Barabbas or do you want this one? And they say, give us Barabbas and kill him. That day, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he's on the cross on Passover, being the Passover lamb, exactly as John the Baptist predicted at the beginning of Jesus' ministry 3.5 years prior to that. The reason that that Wednesday afternoon they were in such a hurry to get him off the cross, as Tom read, that they went and begged for the body, and so they sent out a Roman guard to make sure he was dead. And that's when they pierced him in the side to make sure that he was completely dead. And they hurried to get him into the tomb because the high day was coming and nobody could do any physical work, like taking bodies off crosses or burying or even touching a dead thing, because then you're ceremonially unclean and you can't participate in any of the high day, week-long stuff. So they were in a big hurry to get him in there, which is why John tells us, and that was a high day. He was in the tomb Wednesday night, sundown, which is the beginning of Thursday. That was a high Sabbath. Everybody went back to their home. Friday, regular day of preparation, weekly Sabbath preparation day. And that's the day when the Jews could then go to Pilate and ask for a guard, because now it's beginning to make sense. They've already said they know it's going to be 3 days. 3 days is the Sabbath day. That's why they can't go guard it. They can't go out there themselves to the tomb, so they have to go to the Gentiles to ask for a guard, because the Gentiles can guard it on the Sabbath day. Makes complete sense, and that's the day that the women could go and buy their spices for the burial. Hang on a second.
First day of the week,
which is also first fruits. He rose on first fruits. But wait, I'll get there.
Okay.
I'm working through the timeline.
Okay.
If he died on Wednesday, sundown Wednesday is the beginning of Thursday. From sundown Wednesday to sundown Thursday, that's 1 day and one night. From sundown Thursday to sundown Friday, that's 2 days and that's 2 nights. From sundown Friday to sundown Saturday is 3 days, 3 nights exactly, and that is Sunday. That is the first day of the week. And so anywhere after sundown Saturday night, he can get up out of the grave, and he's fulfilled 72 hours. And as I mentioned earlier, when the women come to the tomb, while it's still dark, before it's light, he's not getting up. They didn't show up there and have a sunrise service. They showed up there, and the tomb was already empty, and he was already gone. But he raised on the first day of the week, which means that he perfectly fulfilled the Passover, he perfectly fulfilled unleavened bread, he perfectly fulfilled first fruits, and then sure enough, the book of Acts begins with 50 days passing, and on Pentecost, the Holy Spirit comes and establishes the church of the new covenant. And those feasts were being kept in that order for 1,400 years by people who didn't understand why they were doing it. But God knew. God was teaching the whole time. God was laying out his plan the whole time.
How did we lose that?
How did we lose it? Because of the Friday-Sunday scenario. The traditions that really start you know, in that Constantinian era, those traditions wipe this out. Okay. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I understand everything except how did he fulfill unleavened bread?
He was the unleavened bread. What does unleavened bread signify? Yeah, flat bread with no yeast, no sin, yeah.
Okay, but he didn't actually do anything. He just...
Yeah, but what did he walk around saying?
I'm the bread.
I am that bread. He broke unleavened bread at the Passover supper, the Lord's Supper, and said, this is my body. And then the next day, his body was in the tomb on the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Right?
Right.
Yes.
The Friday, Saturday, Sunday concept, is that the reasoning behind Good Friday?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. But you don't find anywhere in the writings of the early church, you don't find anything about Good Friday. You don't find, in fact, what you find among the early church, because of the very heavy Jewish and Israelite influence, what you find is the early church continuing to recognize and celebrate Passover, but doing it, like we talked about in our Lord's Supper communion service, recognizing that Jesus changed the focus. For 1,400 years, Passover was always about remember the deliverance from Egypt. Remember that deliverance. Then Jesus said, as often as you do this, remember me. He didn't say quit doing it. He said, and as often as you do it, which would still be yearly, now change your focus to me. Remember me. Still take this wine, still drink this cup, which is why Paul then picked it up in the Corinthian church. And he said, as often as you eat this bread and as often as you drink this cup, what bread, what cup? The unleavened bread, the cup that was the after dinner cup of part of the Passover. And so the language is very specific where the early church is concerned, and 2,000 years, we've lost the specificity of the language. So,
and he said, do it until I come again.
And do it till I come again, and I won't do it till I do it with you again in the kingdom. And so by the time Paul carries it to the Corinthian church, he's carried that very Jewish, very Israelitish idea into a Gentile setting and said, but keep doing it and remember Christ as you do it. And so that's why we do once a year communion. We usually do it on, you know, what's called Easter Sunday or Resurrection Sunday, because that's usually the Sunday closest to Passover, because we're trying to get as close as we can to that New Testament model. Yes, sir.
When I was growing up, it seemed the Catholic Church was the one that stressed the 3 hours of Good Friday.
Yeah.
Is there something in the Catholic Church that... switched it to that period?
Oh, no, it's clear in the Bible that he was on the cross for 3 hours, because the 3 hours of darkness.
But he was always on Good Friday.
Right, they always emphasize it on Good Friday. Yes.
Is it something in the Catholic Church that caused that?
Well, yes, because when you talk about Constantinianism again, that all took place in Rome. And so it's the Roman Church that was the first church to start inculcating these Babylonish ideas into Christianity, and then Rome became the primary power and the primary church in Europe, which is why the Eastern Constantinople church broke off and became the Eastern Orthodox Church, so as not to recognize the Pope at Rome, and that's why their traditions, some are the same and some are different. But yes, you can trace all of this back to the Roman Catholic Church. Yeah.
That's where it started, pretty much.
Yeah. And, you know, as much as I love the reformers, and I love the credo, always reforming, I wish that once they had started reforming from the Catholic Church, that they had just kept going and going and going. We are truly a reformed church because we just keep reforming and keep reforming. And I grew up with as many traditions as anybody else. But I've been willing, whenever the Bible convinces me that my tradition's incorrect, I've been willing to toss the tradition in favor of, but what does the Word say? So now we're only partway done. Oh dear, I gotta move. Because these first four feasts are not the end of it. God went on and established three more feasts. All of these feasts collectively, these first four, took place in the spring every year. And then, of course, you'd come to Pentecost. You'd count 50 days, and then you would bring in your new grain offering. Starting at verse 17, You shall bring in from your dwelling places two loaves of bread for a wave offering made of 2/10 of an ephah, and there will be fine flour baked with leaven as first fruits to the Lord. Along with the bread, you shall present 7 1-year-old lambs without defect, and a bull from the herd, and 2 rams, and they are to be burnt offerings to the Lord with their grain offerings and their libations, an offering of fire, a soothing aroma to the Lord. And you'll offer 1 male goat for a sin offering, and 2 male lambs, 1 year old, for a sacrifice of peace offerings. The priest shall then wave them with the bread of the first fruits for a wave offering with 2 lambs. Before the Lord, they are to be holy to the Lord for the priest. That's a lot of offerings on that day. And on this same day, you shall make a proclamation as well. You're to have a holy convocation on that 50th day, on the Pentecost day. And you'll do no laborious work. So Pentecost is what?
A Sabbath.
Is a Sabbath. But what day does Pentecost fall on?
Sunday.
We know it falls on Sunday. So it's a Sunday Sabbath. And it's a high day. Pardon me?
Wow,
two Sabbaths in a row. You got your Saturday Sabbath, your weekly Sabbath, then you've got your Sunday Sabbath. Yep. On the same day, you shall make a proclamation as well. You are to have a holy convocation. You will do no laborious work. It is to be a perpetual statute in all your dwelling places throughout your generations. In other words, don't forget to do this. When you reap the harvest of your land, moreover, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor gather the gleanings of your harvest. You're to leave them for the needy and for the alien. I am the Lord your God. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say, in the 7th month, on the 1st day of the month, you shall have a rest of reminder by a blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. So now you've got the first day of the 7th month, you're going to have a feast of blowing trumpets.
There's a feast of trumpets.
This is the feast of trumpets. And it's going to happen on the 1st day of the 7th month. It'll be a rest and a reminder by blowing trumpets. You shall not do any laborious work. You shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, on exactly the 10th day of this 7th month, is the day of atonement. So now on the 10th day of the 7th month is the Feast of Atonement. A smart man would have started writing smaller so that he had more room at the bottom.
I still love you.
Thank you. Verse 28, neither shall you do any work on this day, for it is a day of atonement, to make atonement on your behalf before the Lord your God. Now, of course, we've seen all that already. We've seen all the rules of the Day of Atonement. We know that the priest has to come in, what he has to be wearing, what he has to have in his hands. He has to have the blood. He has to sprinkle the blood. He has to take it into the holy place. So we know what the Day of Atonement is. Now we know that it's done once a year on the 10th day of the 7th month. If there is any person who will not humble himself on the same day, he shall be cut off from his people. This is a very, very high, important day. But notice that it happens on the 10th day of the month. So what day of the week is that?
Wednesday.
I mean, we don't know. Well,
we don't know.
Right.
It can be...
I was thinking the first day of the 7th month, but that's not necessarily Sunday.
No, it's not.
The trumpets is a high day, right? So we don't know what day it is.
Right. It's just on the 1st day of the 7th month. So this can be any day of the week again. Then he says, you shall do no work at all. It is to be a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. It is to be a Sabbath of complete rest to you, and you shall humble your souls. On the 9th of the month at evening, which is the beginning of the 10th day, so on the 9th of the month at evening, from evening until evening, you shall keep the Sabbath. Now, what does that mean when he says evening to evening? He called that whole evening to evening
24 hours.
Yeah, 24 hours a day. So does Jesus know what a day and a night is? In fact, does God know what a day and a night is? Does God understand 24 hours? Does God understand evening to evening, constituting a 24-hour period. Yes, of course. Therefore, the next time you flip on the radio or the TV and you hear somebody trying to explain the Friday to Sunday scenario, and they start in with that, well, Jewish idiomatic thing, just understand that the Bible is very clear about it. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, on the 15th of this seventh month is a feast of booths for 7 days to the Lord. So starting on the 15th day, 5 days after the Day of Atonement, you're going to have the Feast of Booths. Now, the reason it's called the Feast of Booths, sometimes called the Feast of Tabernacles, is that all the Israelites had to move out of their permanent dwellings and build temporary dwellings to live in for a while. For 7 days, you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day, you shall have a holy convocation and present an offering by fire to the Lord. It is an assembly, and you shall do no laborious work. Everybody who could travel had to come to Israel for that. These are the appointed times of the Lord, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, to present offerings by fire to the Lord, burnt offerings and grain offerings, sacrifices and libations, each day's matter on its own day, besides those of the Sabbath of the Lord, and besides your gifts, and besides all your votive and free will offerings, which you give to the Lord. On exactly the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the crops of your land, you shall celebrate the feast of the Lord for 7 days, with a rest on the first day and a rest on the eighth day. Now, on the first day, you shall take for yourselves the foliage of beautiful trees, palm branches and boughs, of leafy trees and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. You shall thus celebrate it as a feast to the Lord for 7 days of the year. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. You shall celebrate it on the seventh month. And you shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths, or tabernacles, or temporary dwelling places, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths when I brought them out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So Moses declared to the sons of Israel the appointed times of the Lord. This concept of a temporary dwelling place is picked up in the New Testament when it says that Jesus came and he tabernacled among us. Really important language, because what that means is that he took up a tent of human flesh and he dwelt inside that tent of human flesh even though he was fully God. And that's being typified here. Now, these fall feasts, the trumpets, the atonements, the booths, there is no direct fulfillment of those anywhere in Jesus' incarnation and earthly ministry. There's no one-for-one equivalent. The Passover, the unleavened bread, the Feast of First Fruits, the Pentecost, there is a one-for-one, very obvious equivalent pointed out in the New Testament, pointed out so clearly that you got to be kind of silly to miss them. But the fall three feasts, nothing. Except that you've got Paul saying things like, when he writes to the Corinthians and he talks about a cataclysmic change that living people are going to go through when Christ returns, that there are going to be some who instantaneously change from corruptible to incorruptible, and that these mortals are going to put on immortality. And he says that's going to happen at a specific time. Do you remember what the time stamp is?
When the trumpet blows.
Not just the trumpet.
Close.
The last trumpet. Now, there's only one place in the Bible where you find a series of trumpets that ends with the last trumpet. Guess where?
Feast of Trumpets.
Feast of Trumpets. All I'm saying is there's a one-for-one equivalence for the first four. There's no such one-for-one equivalence for the last three, but Paul drops these little hints. And he does talk about, on the last trump, we're all going to be changed. And we know that because the first four were perfectly fulfilled, we expect the last three to be fulfilled in the same sequential order in some significant way. The first four were perfectly in order. The next three are going to have to be perfectly in order. Go to the book of Zechariah. It's the second to the last book in the Old Testament. Go to the book of Zechariah. Book of Zechariah, chapter 14. Very last chapter of that book. Now, I will tell you that Zechariah has an astounding batting average going. He's very much like Isaiah in terms of being just perfectly accurate in his predictions. He is often quoted and referenced in the New Testament. Zechariah 14 begins with a description of God pouring out wrath on the planet, and he picks up a phrase that is used throughout the Old Testament for the particular time when God pours out his wrath on the planet. That time is called the Day of the Lord, a very eschatological phrase, and what it means is the time of God's wrath. Chapter 14 begins with a description of the time of God's wrath. Whenever that's going to be, it's yet a future thing. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. He's writing to Israel, and he's saying, God's going to restore to you everything that's been taken from you. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravaged, and half of the city will be exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on the day of battle. And in that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem to the east, and the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half of the mountain will move toward the north and the other half toward the south. There's something you can check. There's a geological reality you can go check. Is the Mount of Olives split at this moment? No. So we're waiting for it to happen. Importantly, did the Mount of Olives split in 70 AD?
No.
When the Lord returns, his feet touch the Mount of Olives, which is a very significant place for the feet of Jesus to touch, considering everything that he did in the Mount of Olives in his first incarnation. And then the mountain's going to split, and you will flee by the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains will reach to Azel. Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him, and it will come about in that day that there will be no light. The luminaries or the stars in the heaven will dwindle, for it will be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but it will come about that at eventime there will be light. And it will come about in that day that living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and the other half toward the western sea. And it will be in summer as well as in winter. In other words, constant flowing living water coming out of Jerusalem. Have we seen that yet? No, it's still a desert over there, isn't it? And the Lord will be king over all the earth in that day. After he's come back and his feet have touched the Mount of Olives, he's going to set up a kingdom where he's going to be the Lord over all the earth. The Lord will be the only one and his name the only one. And all the land will be changed into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. But Jerusalem will rise and remain on its site from Benjamin's gate as far as the place of the first gate to the corner gate and from the tower of Hananel to the king's wine presses. Then people will live in it, and there will be no more curse, for Jerusalem will dwell in security. Has Jerusalem ever dwelt in security?
No.
And is there still a curse?
Yes.
Yes. This is future. Now, this will be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet, and their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongue will rot in their mouth. And it will come about in that day that a great panic from the Lord will fall on them, and they will seize one another's hands, and the hand of one will be lifted against the hand of another. Well, yeah. I mean, when your eyes are rotting out and your tongue's rotting out, yeah, there's just going to be a massive slaying taking place among the enemies of Israel and Judah. also will fight at Jerusalem, says verse 14, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations will be gathered, gold and silver and garments in great abundance. So also, like this plague, will be the plague on the horse and the mule and the camel and the donkey and all the cattle that will be in all those camps. Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went up against Jerusalem will go up year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths. What? Isn't that odd?
Yeah, not all the other seven, just that one.
Not the other seven, just that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will have been fulfilled.
But wait, there's more. And it will be that whichever of the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. And if the family of Egypt does not go up or enter, then no rain will fall on them. It will be the plague with which the Lord smites the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that will not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. And in that day, there will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holiness to the Lord. And the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the bowls before the altar. In other words, there's no more common. Everything is holy. Everything is sanctified. And every cooking pot in Jerusalem and in Judah will be holy to the Lord of hosts. And all who sacrifice will come and take of them and boil in them, and there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts in that day. And that's how Zechariah ends. So that chapter starts with the day of the Lord and the punishment, and then a regathering of Israel, an establishment of the kingdom, and there being holiness to the Lord throughout the kingdom of God. The Lord himself is ruling on the planet, and year by year, all the Gentile nations that fought against Israel have to come up and worship before the Lord, and they have to keep the Feast of Booths. Why?
He's not going to put them up at all day.
Yeah, it's remarable. Now, just so you know, just so you get it, just so you understand my thinking, the fulfillment of the Feast of Booths is there in Zechariah. That's clear. All the time, year by year, fulfillment of the Feast of Booths. Pardon me?
Through the millennium.
I think so, because I think the millennium follows the day of the Lord.
Yeah.
Now, if the Feast of Booths is the fulfillment of the millennium, what happens just before the millennium?
Day of Atonement.
The Day of Atonement, also known as the Day of the Lord. He described it. And then, before those two can happen, there's this thing called the Feast of Trumpets. And the only place in the Bible where there's any connection to the Feast of Trumpets is the trumpet call that gathers the church to go to the Lord. It's the only place where there's any fulfillment to it. It's the only biblical fulfillment you find anywhere. So sometimes, again, when people say to me, well, where do you get that eschatological scheme that you have where you say that first the church is taken out, and then the day of the Lord, and then there's a millennium where the Lord is actually ruling on the planet? Well, it was taught for 1,400 years in the fall feasts that were packaged with the spring feasts, and the spring feasts were fulfilled perfectly and in order in his first incarnation. I contend that the remaining three will also be fulfilled in perfect order in his second return to the planet, because they all redound to the glory of Christ. And that's where I get this stuff that I, you know, make up in my wacky head.
So. After the last trumpet, the Israelites were coming from Egypt. They moved on the last
trumpet. The last trumpet is always for gathering. It's a gathering. And so there's the voice of an archangel and the voice of a trumpet, and the church is gathered. It makes perfect sense. Yes?
I was just going to clarify, so that might be what they call the rapture, the Feast of Trumpets and the rapture. And
yeah.
Then God comes back, he punishes his enemy, Day of Atonement.
Yep.
And then we live 1,000 years as with Jesus as our King, and that's Feast of Booths.
Yeah. And isn't it remarkable how those fit?
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it remarkable that that scenario has been around for 3,400 years now? And all I'm arguing for is that you let the Bible speak.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.